This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. How did the Republican Party end up with a presidential candidate like Donald Trump and the Freedom Caucus in the House of Representatives that forced out House Speaker John Boehner? The answer, E.J. Dion says, can be found more than half a century ago in the politics of Barry Goldwater, who famously said, "Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice." Goldwater lost his bid for the White House and gave rise to an uncompromising conservatism, according to our guest. E.J. Dion has a new book called Why the Right Went Wrong, and it's about the history of contemporary American conservatism and a story of disappointment and betrayal. E.J. Dion has been a longtime observer of American politics. He does commentary on NPR's All Things Considered. He's a regular analyst for MSNBC. He's a columnist for The Washington Post, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and a professor at Georgetown University. And E.J. Dion, nice to have you with us on Radio Time.
It is so great to be here. Thanks for having me. And I love Philly, as I told you, so it's good to be here.
We all love Philly. You say this is a story of disappointment and betrayal, but it seems in 2016, I think almost everybody in this country, liberal and conservative, feel some sense of betrayal and disappointment in our political system.
Well, I do think there is a broad sense of disappointment, although it expresses itself somewhat differently on the right and on the left. There are some brute facts of American life that everybody has to deal with. The economic changes of the last 30 years, particularly the decline in blue-collar incomes, the decline in well-paying blue-collar jobs, and this the sense that maybe our kids won't have it as well as we did, which is, you know, a very un-American thought, you might say. And so I think that underlies a lot of it. It certainly explains on the Democratic side a part of where Bernie Sanders comes from. And then the particular anger and frustration created by the economic collapse of 2008 and the sense that, Wall Street and financiers were responsible for that. But on the conservative side, I think there are a couple of very particular things that are going on. As you said, the book argues that the history of American conservatism is a story of disappointment and betrayal, and that ever since Goldwater, conservative politicians have made a series of promises that they couldn't keep. And at some level, they knew they couldn't keep. They kept promising a much smaller government. They promised to roll back the cultural change of the 60s. And lately, they've also been suggesting they can change the ethnic makeup of the country back to what it used to be. It's a pushback against how diverse we've become since the 1965 Immigration Act. Just to take the size of government, there's a problem with that promise because no matter what they think of government in theory, most Americans want quite a lot from government. One of the points I make in the book is that a lot of Tea Partiers who are very anti-government will nonetheless say, but we are at or over 65. We do want our Social Security and Medicare. And they explain this by saying, well, these were earned benefits, unlike these other benefits. But if you're not going to cut those programs, doing so would be unpopular. If you're going to increase defense spending, and then there's a whole lot of other government that's very popular. So there is this frustration. I think Donald Trump reflects both of these issues that you raised at the very beginning. On the one side, there is an angry white working class that has voted loyally Republican for election after election and really doesn't have much to show for it. And as I argue in the book, there were conservatives like Ross Douthat, who now writes a column for the New York Times, Raihan Salam, who really warned the party that these folks, Sam's Club Republicans, Governor Tim Pawlenty called them, were eventually going to revolt if the party delivered nothing to them. This is Trump's base. But the other side is just this sense of promises made and not kept. And I quote Eric Erickson from the Red State blog, who said the Republican Party created Donald Trump by making a lot of promises they didn't keep. They stoked this anger, didn't deliver on it, and Trump is reaping the whirlwind.
Well, going back to your essential thesis, which is one of the reasons that conservatives, as you say, have this sense of disappointment and betrayal, is that they've had candidates who have promised things that they have not delivered. Are you saying, though, that these candidates, whether they were Reagan or whether they were Nixon or whether they were the two Bushes, knew that they were promising something they couldn't deliver, knew that this is how you're going to get elected, and once they got into office, then essentially abandon what it was that they had promised their voters?
Well, I think in some cases there was ambivalence. In other cases, there was a mixture of conviction and a real sense that they were doing things for political purposes. Nixon, it was fascinating. It's always fascinating to explore Richard Nixon.
Absolutely.
Truly one of the most complicated human beings ever to enter American politics. And, you know, it's funny, and Chris Matthews points this out in a great book he wrote many years ago about Kennedy and Nixon. In their very first election, Kennedy ran, called himself a conservative back in 1946, and Nixon actually called himself a liberal when he ran for Congress in 1946.
Well, and Nixon in many ways seems like a liberal. EPA, OSHA, affirmative action, health care, open door policy to China, a minimum guaranteed income for poor families.
Right. Nixon care was far more radical than Obamacare. If you look back at the plan he proposed, it was one of the great regrets, by the way, of Ted Kennedy's life that he didn't just enact what Richard Nixon proposed. He wanted something more aggressive, but you know, he said later in life, if we'd enacted that, we would have been on the road to universal health coverage. On the other hand, Nixon was acutely aware. Nixon almost felt the Republican Party in his bones, and he knew that after Eisenhower and after his defeat, narrow defeat in 1960, with Goldwater's victory, the party had moved sharply right, and he knew that he had to put himself right with that part of the party if he was going to win the nomination. So he very carefully positioned himself. And a person who wrote about this in a very interesting way, and I interviewed him for the book and cite him some of one of his books, is Pat Buchanan, who noted that right in the 68 Nixon campaign, the one he won, his comeback campaign, his whole staff was divided into two that reflected the two minds of Richard Nixon. There were the right-wingers like Buchanan and some of his allies who really wanted Nixon to go hard on the social issues, hard on crime, hard on race. And then there were the more moderate Nixon types who represented the older kind of Eisenhower Republicans who said, wait a minute, no, you don't want to go there. And Nixon was constantly torn between these. But we remember him as more of a right-wing figure because he pursued the Southern strategy of getting white votes, white working class votes, particularly in the South, but also in urban areas of the Northeast and Midwest. And so that Nixon has stuck with us. But a lot of conservatives were already revolting against Nixon back when he was president. There was a little manifesto signed by a group of conservatives who said they were withdrawing their support from Nixon. Some of them came back to support him over McGovern, but others just never cottoned to Nixon. My favorite, however, is a conservative called Stan Evans, famous on the right at the time, who said, the only time I started liking Nixon was after Watergate. And of course, he liked Nixon then because all the liberals were out to get him. And at that point, he was going to support Nixon as a conservative.
I know those kind of people. I think maybe the more interesting or sort of in certain ways the more confounding of the Republican presidents is Ronald Reagan. And as you say, you quote someone who said, you can choose your Reagan. You can choose which one that you believe was the true man. But again, this is a man who said one thing, it seems, and did something else, whether it was about immigration, whether it was about and numbers of immigrants allowed into this country, whether it was about raising taxes, about government spending, the size of government. All that grew under Reagan. And yet you hear today people pointing back to his administration saying, I'm a Ronald Reagan Republican or conservative.
Right. I opened the book with a chapter on Reagan called The Ambiguous Hero, precisely because he is genuinely ambiguous. The quote, you can choose your Reagan, is from Charles Krauthammer, the conservative columnist. As I say, one of the things I did for the book is, and it was actually a really interesting experience because people know I'm a liberal of social democratic leanings. You know, my views are clear from my column.
Right.
But the conservatives I spoke to understood I was trying to figure out the story. And so I think they were under no illusions that they were going to convert me, but they really helped me understand this trajectory. And so, you know, in the middle of this interview, Charles said, you can choose your Reagan. And that's exactly right, because Reagan, on the one hand, was a movement hero. And, one of the great ironies, perhaps, of American politics is there were two politicians who came to prominence because of one speech in recent years. One is, of course, Barack Obama with the 2004 Democratic Convention, No Red or Blue America speech. But the other was Ronald Reagan with a 1964 speech broadcast a week before Goldwater lost that election. And all over the country, when conservatives saw this guy, this actor who had been speaking up for conservatism since he converted from being an FDR Democrat back in the 50s, said, this is our guy. This is the guy who's going to save us. And that Reagan really was a hardcore movement conservative. He didn't like Medicare. He didn't like Social Security. He was a hard anti-communist. He didn't like unions. He didn't like farm subsidies, just like Goldwater. But then he got himself elected governor of California, and he had to govern. And he often had to govern with Democrats controlling some house of some either state legislature or later Tip O'Neill and the Congress. And he was willing to adjust, and he was more pragmatic when he governed. You know, he cut taxes deeply and then raised them a bunch of times and sort of acted as if he wished he didn't have to do it, but he did do it. And as you say, and I think the betrayal many conservatives felt was in the end one of Reagan's greatest triumphs that even liberals, I think, identify with, which is he identified Gorbachev as a different kind of communist.
That's right.
Early on. And he, like Margaret Thatcher, was willing to do business with Gorbachev. And I argue that it may be a paradox that conservatives point to the arms buildup and Reagan's tough rhetoric, tear down this wall, as winning the Cold War. Well, maybe that's true, but it could also be the peace-minded Reagan who never particularly liked nuclear weapons and who said, no, I can do business with Gorbachev, and to the great horror of conservatives, nearly negotiated away all of our nuclear weapons. I don't think it was ever going to get there, but in the talks in Reykjavik, a lot of hardcore conservatives were very, very worried about Reagan.
Well, about a minute before our first break here, and maybe because I'm a radio person, I always think that there was something so smooth, almost and seductive about Ronald Reagan's voice. I mean, just the way he spoke, the timbre of his voice had a kind of soothing quality to it.
I totally agree. I mean, there was liberals, when they lost to Reagan, sometimes tried to let themselves off the hook by arguing there's some magic going on here, I think there was more going on substantively than for a while liberals wanted to admit. On the other hand, yes, and I think one of the fascinating things about the voice and his approach is that he was an FDR Democrat, and he never lost the lessons that he learned from FDR, who, after all, was a radio guy, too.
That's right.
The fireside chat. So he later used FDR's methods against FDR's politics.
Well, let's take that short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. E.J. Dionne is our guest, and he's got a brand new book called Why the Right Went Wrong, subtitled Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. If that voice is familiar, it's because you hear our guest on NPR's All Things Considered, where he does political commentary. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with E.J. Dionne about his new book. And again, it's called Why the Right Went Wrong. And it looks at about almost 60 years of political history going back to Barry Goldwater, his bid for the White House, his failed bid for the White House, and how that gave rise to an uncompromising conservatism, according to our guests. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Well, marching through history here, looking at some of these Republican presidential candidates, you've got George Herbert Walker Bush, 41. You've got George W. Bush, 43. We've got Jeb, who would be 45 if he wins, although he's clearly struggling with his bid for the White House. And I do want to talk some more about that. But how do you see the role of the Bushes in this thesis that you have?
Well, the Bushes had, in both the case of the president father and the president's son, had different kinds of ambivalences about conservatism. If you go back one generation further to Prescott Bush, the grandfather to W., he was an Eisenhower Republican. He even talked – he used the term progressive moderation at one point to describe what Republicans should be. And then the Bush family moved south to Texas, and so did their politics. So George H.W. Bush became more conservative than his father. And yet there was still this streak of his father in him. The way I see H.W. Bush, he was trying to rationalize Reaganism, moderate it, and turn it into a sustainable governing project. And for him, part of that governing project was making it fiscally responsible. And if you ask the question, why is it that now Republicans can't seem to support a tax increase for anything, even things Republicans traditionally liked, like building roads? The answer lies in George H.W. Bush's decision to make a deal with Democrats to raise taxes to cut the deficit in 1990. And lo and behold came Newt Gingrich, who led a revolt in among House Republicans against that tax increase. Bush later made a deal with the Democrats to raise taxes anyway that was actually not as conservative as the first deal that the Republicans voted down because he had to deal mostly with Democrats. That plus a recession was kind of the end of George H.W. Bush. And, you know, one of the things I talk about is how the first Bush almost died politically for Reagan's sins, because a lot of conservatives who still wanted to hold up Reagan as a hero didn't really want to talk much about the fact that he'd raised taxes too.
Exactly.
And got away with it. But they kind of really didn't believe in his heart of hearts that Reagan wanted to do it, whereas they believed in their heart of hearts that Bush did. And so this effort to modernize conservatism a little bit went down. Along comes W. Now, W's politics and Karl Rove's politics were fascinating because they came at the end of the Clinton years. And I talk a lot about the Clinton years in the book and impeachment as reflecting the kind of radicalization in the party and also the polarization in the country that was already setting in under Bill Clinton. W and Karl Rove saw that Clinton had actually changed the Democratic Party enough that the Republicans couldn't keep running the same old campaigns against liberalism, and also that the conservatism of Gingrich and the Congress was not all that popular. So along came compassionate conservatism. And if Clinton talked about a third way, Bush was almost talking about a fourth way. So he'd make the Republicans more acceptable to moderate middle class voters by talking a lot about education. He'd be sort of talk about compassion toward the poor. He proposed a prescription drug benefit under Medicare. This could have he might have modernized the right successfully. But after the 2000 election and Bush lost the popular vote to Al Gore, this is something Karl Rove had not expected, and he discovered from polling that actually the country was so polarized that there wasn't much of a middle. And so he went back to mobilizing the base, and then, of course, came 9/11, which kind of buried compassionate conservatism, and Republicans in Congress didn't think much of that idea anyway.
But what's so interesting, when you throw Clinton into the mix as well, I mean, famous for what, triangulation? I mean, in a sense, kind of stealing Republican ideas and giving them a Democratic cast or shading to them.
Right. If I could jump ahead to the end of the story where we'll get eventually, I do think there's a kind of magic number of three in politics. A party loses three elections in a row and something happens. You know, Democrats had lost three elections in a row in the 1980s, and they were prepared to make some adjustments in order to win again. And I have a kind of a complicated view of the Clinton adjustments because I thought some were necessary. I mean, you can be tough on crime, but also tough on the causes of crime, as Tony Blair put it, a Clinton ally from Britain.
Right.
On the other hand, when you look at the crime bill that was passed, it created the over-incarceration we see today. Similarly, you can be for pro-work welfare, but I think the bill they passed was insufficiently generous to the poor. And of course, now we see the problems with the financial deregulation that happened in the Clinton years. But some of those corrections were necessary. My hunch is to create a more moderate and modern conservatism that I am talking about in this book, that I think is where conservatives need to go. They may have to suffer a third presidential defeat this year, and perhaps with a firmly conservative nominee. In some ways, if Ted Cruz were to win the Republican nomination, no conservative could say this is a tepid rhino, you know, Republican in name only. And if Ted Cruz ran and lost, then I think it's not so much the opening of the conservative mind. It's that those conservatives who know that some change has to happen might begin to find more courage and push things a little farther than they've been able to push them now.
So I'm interested in how you see then Donald Trump as part of this narrative. As you said, looking back at the kind of disappointment that conservatives have had in this country because they've had candidates who promise them things and then they can't deliver. It seems like he is the living embodiment of that because much of what he says, if he were to become president of the United States, he would not be able to deliver. I mean, there is a Congress, for instance, that you have to go through. There are treaties that you have to deal with other countries, for instance.
But doesn't Donald Trump get along easily with everyone? No. I mean, that is an interesting that is a very interesting issue. The other problem with Trump for conservatives, and a lot of them are coming to see this, the National Review, the kind of beacon journal of the American right, wrote a whole issue attacking Trump. It was one essay after another on the varieties of opposition to Trump. His mix is not the traditional conservative mix. Yes, he's very hardcore on immigration, to the right of where Reagan or George W. Bush were. Yes, he's really tough on law and order. He said things, I think, that you can only call outright racist, what he said about Mexicans, Mexican immigrants and being rapists, and quoting Trump, murderers and rapists. So there is that hardcore side of him. On the other hand, there is the Trump who has criticized the Iraq war, this week saying saying things Democrats have been timid about saying, that, well, Bush kept us safe, but 9/11 happened on his watch. So you have him being much more not a neoconservative, for sure, on foreign policy. You have him ripping trade treaties, talking very much like Bernie Sanders or a labor Democrat when it comes to free trade. Lately, he's also talked about the government has to negotiate lower prices for Medicare on prescription drugs. That's been a Democratic cause for 20 years. So
talk about triangulation,
yeah, so,
right?
Yeah. So Trump is definitely there's a strong populism there. Trump is a very complicated figure. And so one of the things you're going to have going on the right is either they're just going to reject him as an alien body were he to win the nomination. But in the long run, I think all of that speaks to the working class voters who drifted Republican, perhaps on backlash on civil rights, perhaps because of social issues, perhaps because they saw liberals as a bunch of pointy-headed elitists, for whatever reasons, wanting more out of Republicans than just rhetoric. And Trump has given them a lot of rhetoric, but he's also giving them some actual positions. And so I think this is also a reckoning for conservatives.
Let me quote something from your book. You say the Trump movement and the Carson surge ought to wake Republicans and conservatives up to the challenges that they face, to the depth of the disaffection among their supporters, and to the cost of the cycle of disappointment and betrayal. And it is interesting, not that the Democrats haven't had wacky candidates from time to time, but you've got Ben Carson, who, an amazing surgeon. It's clear he's not doesn't have the qualifications to be president of the United States. You've got Donald Trump, who doesn't, follow any of the rules. There was Herman Cain in the past who talked about 999, Michelle Bachmann. What is it about the Republican Party that these kinds of candidates feel that they can find a home?
Well, I think there is within conservatism and a large part of the Republican Party a deep unhappiness with what America is becoming. And that whole slogan that was so popular, take our country back. Well, take our country back from what exactly? And on the one hand, it's a brilliant slogan because you can take it back from it's like a Rorschach test. Take it back from the Democrats. Take it back from Obama. Or it can mean take it back from immigrants, from the ethnic change in the ethnic makeup of the country. And this is not unique to our moment. We've had these kind of rebellions against change before. We eventually come to terms with the change. What is now said about Latinos used to be said about Italians or for my own French Canadians when we came down over the border from Quebec. or take our country back from these terrible unchristian values and gay marriage and the like. So there is this unhappiness with what America is becoming. And I think that's very much part of the disappointment on the right. And I think when I identify the problems on the right, one of the big ones is that increasingly conservatism is a movement of older white Americans. Now, heck, there's nothing wrong with older white Americans. I happen to be an older white American. But you can't build your future in the United States in 2016 on older white Americans. First of all, eventually, we older folks go to our eternal reward, and we are replaced by younger people. Younger people are decidedly against this kind of conservatism. In these primaries, they're being much more drawn in to the Democratic primaries. They voted two-thirds for Barack Obama in 2008, about 60% in 2012. And the country is becoming more diverse, more Latino, more Asian, more African-American. If the Republicans stay on this course, they cannot possibly win in the long term. This is fine for them to win midterm elections. A lot of my conservative friends say, hey.
Or primaries, I guess.
Yes, and primaries. But a lot of my conservative friends say, hey, if conservatism is in so much trouble, why do we have all these governorships and the like? And the answer is yes. Younger voters, the Democrats are now a younger coalition. They don't vote in midterm elections. Democrats do have to figure out how to turn out their midterm vote. But Republicans have done well in 2010 and 2014. But for the long run, that's not a good indicator because this is a party so dependent on older Americans. Conservatism was much younger when Reagan was president. Only about 37% of people who call themselves conservative were over 50. Now it's like 53-54%, and it's going up.
And that's E.J. Dionne, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, a very familiar voice for listeners to NPR, does commentary on All Things Considered. And he's got a new book called Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. I do want to talk about the Tea Party, and I want to give out that phone number again, and it's 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Actually, let me get Bob from Milford, New Jersey, to join our conversation. Bob, go ahead. You're on the air.
My question is, if Trump receives the nomination without his device of name-calling, would the Cruz supporters or others vote for him and vice versa? If Cruz received the nomination after all this bitter infighting, do you think Trump supporters would actually vote for him? Is there a historical preference for this divisive nominating process?
Is there historical precedence for a divisive nominating
process? Yeah, so there
process,
are historical precedents. I mean, I do think 64, when there was the real showdown between Goldwater and the more moderate Republicans, was almost as divisive as this. But Trump is such a unique figure. I mean, you have to reach for people like Silvio Berlusconi in Italy or other kinds of figures, you know, to some degree Marine Le Pen in France for somebody quite like Trump. But I think it will be very complicated for the Republicans if Trump wins. On the one hand, he may have appeal to some of the blue collar voters who generally vote Democratic in some of the mid-Atlantic states right here in Pennsylvania,
right.
For example. But I think a lot of traditional conservatives would bolt. I actually did an event yesterday with Bill Kristol, prominent conservative, on the book and arguing about conservatism, you know, and Kristol said flatly, I couldn't support Donald Trump. I would hope there would be a third party conservative nominee. So I think a certain kind of ideological conservative would bolt. But I also think there is a different kind of quiet suburban conservative, if you will. And especially if it ended up being a choice between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. I think Hillary Clinton, to that person, would look more small-C conservative as a kind of safe harbor compared to Trump. So I think we'd really scramble our politics. I think other Republicans would stick with him and hope for the best. Mm. But I think it could well be an explosion if he wins the Republican nomination. And if he wins in South Carolina, he is on a path where that is very plausible. The ceiling on Trump is – a lot of the people who aren't for him are against him. And so if the field narrows, but then the question is, does it narrow to two or to three?
Hmm.
And if it narrows to three, he might still sneak in with less than a majority of the vote.
you call for in this book a kind of return to this Eisenhower Republican. And who exemplifies that? Is there a candidate you think that exemplifies that?
I don't think anybody. I think it's something they would have to go back to, and you'd need some new forces in the party and maybe some newly elected people. I think in this campaign, the guy who talks that way the most is John Kasich. And it's the coalition he put together in New Hampshire was a kind of Eisenhower coalition. He ran second because he got a lot of moderate Republicans and moderate conservative Republicans and a lot of independents who could cross over and vote in the Republican Party. And he's somebody who talks about unity, who says, look, we have to worry about poor people. He expanded Medicaid under Obamacare in Ohio, which, of course, many conservatives hold against him. And he fought his own party on that. But I think you'd need one other person, by the way, who agrees with me on Eisenhower as a conservative is Joe Scarborough, which I discovered when I had been writing the book. And I went back to Joe's book on conservatism, and I saw that he told conservatives, stop looking at Ike as a liberal in golf cleats. You know, and what I argue is Eisenhower was a much more classic Edmund Burke kind of conservative. On the one hand, he was pro-business. He was a real fiscally prudent president. He was very careful with the budget. He was prudent in foreign policy. America got stronger, but he didn't intervene a lot. There were some interventions, you know, covert interventions, some of which I'm a liberal. I probably wouldn't have supported. But he was sort of broadly which I wouldn't have supported. He was broadly conservative, but he understood that the New Deal had become part of the American way of life, that it wasn't going to be rolled back, and that there was a role for government, something Republicans like Abraham Lincoln and his hero Henry Clay recognized. So he supported two big investment programs in America's future. One was the Interstate Highway System, and the other was the Federal Student Loan Program, which helped millions, including me, go to college. So I think Eisenhower, you can't go back to the 50s. But I think the spirit, prudence, moderation, preservation that Eisenhower represents is a useful model for the future.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation with E.J. Dionne about his new book, Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. So what explains the rise of the Tea Party and the popularity of Donald Trump? Our guest E.J. Dionne says, look back more than 50 years to the presidential candidacy of Barry Goldwater to explain the current discontent on the right and the bitter conflicts within the Republican Party. Again, his book is Why the Right Went Wrong. He's a syndicated columnist for The Washington Post, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a commentator on NPR. And we've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. I see a bunch of comments, Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You had a story not so long ago in the Washington Post headline, Republican self-destruction is fun to watch, but bad for us all. And I think one of the questions is, and as you remark in this piece, Democrats might be very happy to know that Donald Trump and Ted Cruz are fighting it out, and whoever wins will probably lose in November. That would be their scenario. But you're saying that's really what's going on is not necessary. It's not good for the country.
Right. There are sort of two obvious questions to ask somebody like me who's written a book like this. On the one side is, why should any conservative listen to a liberal and his suggestions about conservatism? And on the other side, why should any liberals worry that conservatism is in this process of self-destruction? You know, on the first side, and I tell the story in the book of that, I actually grew up in a conservative family.
Right.
I started becoming a liberal when I was about 13 years old, and I love to talk about that, but I won't burden your listeners with that. But I do not look at conservatives as some strange group of people out there that you study the way anthropologists study others. I get why conservatism is attractive to people, and indeed, as I argue in the book, I think a healthy conservatism is essential to all small d Democratic polities. You know, we liberals sometimes propose things that don't work, that need to be challenged, that tradition is not always to be rejected. It can be revered. There are times you need to overthrow it when it's used to justify things like slavery or discrimination. But there is value in tradition, our constitutional tradition that you talked about in the previous hour.
Right.
And also, I am somebody who does not believe, and here I share a conservative view, that human nature cannot be remolded by government or any other force. I think human nature is a given. So I want a functional conservatism, but I think liberals should care about it because at the heart of our inability to govern ourselves, particularly over the last 8 years when President Obama has been in office, is the kind of obstructionist conservatism that even rejects ideas that conservatives as recently as 5-10 years before Obama proposed and says, no, those are no longer acceptable. We're
like,
not going to govern ourselves.
For the
like
the
healthcare, Obamacare. Far more conservative than what Nixon proposed, far more conservative than what Clinton proposed, built on some ideas from the Heritage Foundation about the healthcare exchanges. The individual mandate was proposed by Republicans as an alternative to the business mandate in Clinton Care. And yet, you know, all of a sudden, they're not going to do business with the Democrats. And if you have a conservatism that has this reflexive anti-government rhetoric, which they can't really act on, but becomes a kind of barrier, we can't govern ourselves. So we who are progressive need a functioning conservatism. This would all be fine if we had a multi-party system and you had a right-wing party right. that had to form coalitions, but that's not the kind of system we have. We have separated powers. We often have divided government. And so repairing our politics, I think, hangs on repairing conservatism. And we could talk about this more, but I do think the evidence is quite clear, and I cite it in the book, that we're dealing with asymmetric polarization. I do believe that the data show that conservatives have moved farther to the right or Republicans have moved farther to the right than Democrats have to the left. Only a third of Republicans call themselves moderate or liberal. Two-thirds of Democrats call themselves moderate or conservatives. These are not equally polarized parties.
Let me read just a couple of comments. An email from Daniel. Hillary is an Eisenhower conservative! An email from Roy. We have $19 trillion of debt. Republicans have pledged to never raise taxes under any circumstances. Can the debt ever be paid down like this? And if not, does this make Republican Party the party of free stuff? We've got a lot of comments here about, I mean, people are in a very reactive and in many ways, as you write in this book, feeling very disappointed and betrayed by our political system.
Well, let me deal real quick with both of those. The Hillary as an Eisenhower Republican is an excellent point. And in fact, one of the things I point out in the book is that Bill Clinton himself, when he ended up focusing so much on the deficit, said, we're just Eisenhower Republicans here. And there's something to that. Now, on the one hand, given Ike was a fairly successful president, we could do worse than Eisenhower Republicanism. And by the way, if no one's out there has read it, read Eisenhower's Farewell Address, which is a really fascinating piece of work. And I think liberals and conservatives will find interesting things in that Farewell Address that he gave just before he left office. But there, you know, and I do think that on the, you know, the left end of the party, the progressive end, a lot of Bernie Sanders people, I suspect that emailer might be a Sanders person saying I'm voting for Sanders over the Eisenhower Republican. On the other question, the point is absolutely right. I mean, the Republicans cannot Clinton argued as president, he said this in his memoirs, that the reason he won, the Republicans lost, was simple math. And that you cannot do the things that Republicans say they will do. You cannot cut taxes, increase spending on the military, and then claim to find cuts you never find and ever balance the budget. And, you know, it was Bill Clinton had to bail out, us from the Reagan deficits. And to his credit, George H.W. Bush started that process. And, you know, we ran a very steep deficit after the Great Crash, but we didn't have a lot of room. There was already a deficit under Bush, and you're supposed to run deficits when the economy goes down. That the stimulus, I believe, really was materially beneficial to the economy and helped keep it going. And by the way, that's another case where you saw obstructionist conservatism. Republican and Democratic presidents alike agreed that in an economic downturn, you needed a stimulus. And yet they pledged on them right at the first day, the Republicans did, that they were going to stop anything that Obama put forward. So I am sympathetic to those two comments, although in fairness to Hillary Clinton, if you look at the program she has actually put out, it is a very broadly progressive program. It's not as left as Bernie's program, but it's broadly within the progressive range. And one of the things I argue in the book is that one of the ways to change conservatism is for progressives to be more aggressive in asserting that government has a legitimate role, that there are problems, that inequality is a real and central issue in our politics, and to try to change the agenda in a way that our conservative friends will also have to respond to that. Oddly, Trump may be responding more than any of the others to the question of inequality.
Interesting. Let me get looks like Jeff from Hockessin, Delaware, to join us. Jeff, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there. Yeah,
this is for your guest. You were saying about the Republicans saying, save our country, and save our country from what? I'm a conservative, and I believe we want to save our country from socialism, from, a party, the Democrats, who foster dependency from their constituency. And, I believe, because I'm 49 years old, and I've gotten where I've been and moved up because of hard work. And I never hear the Democrats ever say anything about hard work, self-reliance. It's just, don't worry about it. It's stacked against you. The deck is, we'll take care of you. And just one more thing, inequality is always going to be there. There's going to be doers, and then there's going to be lazy people. And that's within social constructs of socialism and capitalism.
Jeff,
my comment.
Sure. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. I'm sure you've heard comments like this.
Yeah,
before.
No, I thank you
like
for
Jeff.
The call. And let me just say, I'm a progressive. I really believe in hard work. In fact, I think that the best statement about the purposes of progressive government came a long time ago from John Stuart Mill, who said that the role of government is to give people help so they can do without help, and that a lot of help is transitional. It's about moving people into work. It's opportunities to go to college so you can better yourself. It's about helping kids early in life. If kids are born in very difficult circumstances and we just let them sit there and don't do anything to help their parents, we are going to have a real problem as a society. So the whole purpose of, I think, government assistance is to create self-reliance in the long run. And my fundamental difference with conservatives is that I do believe there are many ways in our history where conservatives have government programs have encouraged self-reliance over time. In Social Security and Medicare, for people who couldn't save for retirement, not because they were spendthrift, but because they didn't have enough money. And the problem, I believe, sir, with your formulation, it's what really caused Mitt Romney problems. Are there lazy people? Oh, there are always lazy people. There are lazy rich people.
Didn't Reagan talk
too.
About welfare queens?
Right. There are also lazy rich people. I like to say to my conservative friends, it's strange that we want the rich to work harder by giving them more money and the poor to work harder by giving them less money. Nonetheless, I'm for social programming that encourages work, but I think that kind of rhetoric has actually hurt conservatism. And Paul Ryan himself, who invented makers and takers, has acknowledged that. But I wish we could have a thoroughgoing argument somewhere over a beer or something, sir, because, I understand. I do identify with your belief in work, and I think most Americans do.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well 1-888-477-9499. We haven't really talked about the Tea Party, which is a part of your subtitle, a very interesting outgrowth of a number of phenomenon. And I think in part what we heard was a criticism of the bailout of the banks. But as you say in this book, E.J. Dionne, there were some powerful forces behind the Tea Party movement.
Right. Well, the chapter on the Tea Party and the rise and where it came from is called The New Old Right. And I think one of the striking things about the Tea Party is that this represented a very, very old form of conservatism. Indeed, if you go back and look at Glenn Beck's show on YouTube and look at the reading list he proposed – Some of the most important works on his reading list were books from the old John Birch Society back in the 50s and 60s, so that the Tea Party was not breaking new ground ideologically. What they did have that was different was Fox News as a wholly new phenomenon started in the 90s. That gave voice to a certain style of conservatism. Even before that, talk radio, Rush Limbaugh was a real pioneer in an effort that led to conservatives taking over large parts of the AM radio dial in many parts of our country. And then you had the money, the Koch brothers that my friend Jane Mayer has written about in her, in her book. And so what you had is David Frum, the maverick conservative, has said, is you had the conservative entertainment complex, which is his words for Fox and talk radio. And then you had the radical rich who were financing a lot of this movement. The Tea Party would not have taken off without an awful lot of logistical support from rather wealthy wealthy conservatism. This was not simply a spontaneous uprising. And it was not something brand new. Most of the activists in the Tea Party were conservative Republicans. As I point out in the book, you already saw them on the campaign trail at the end of the 2008 campaign when they were saying things about Barack Obama, you know, the things you heard a lot later about his not really being an American and all that, that John McCain himself often pushed back against.
He famously pushed back.
Said that, no, he's not a Muslim and he's an American and he was born here. And so the Tea Party was a brilliant creation and it grabbed public attention, but it wasn't that new and it wasn't widespread. It was the same old, and it's legitimate, it's a legitimate point of view, the same old 20-25% of the country that was on the right wing of our political spectrum.
You're an analyst for MSNBC, and you mentioned Fox News. And, you know, I'm someone that channel surfs like a lot of people, interested in a lot of political news. I think it must be said that MSNBC is obsessed with Donald Trump. And from my perspective, given him a lot of free attention and most of it not particularly critical attention. And I'm curious your perspective on how the media, broadly speaking, but I think the broadcast media, what they have done to enable Donald Trump's candidacy.
I think when this campaign is over, people are going to look back and ask the question, why was there so much logistical support given by the media in pursuit of ratings to the Donald Trump candidacy? There was a study of another network that showed fairly early on when it was clear that Bernie was taking off and Trump was taking off, that Trump was getting about 80-1 in terms of coverage. And yet, if you look at the percentage of support for these two folks in the electorate, Bernie at the time probably had more actual people in the electorate saying I'm for Bernie than there were people saying I'm for Trump. Now they're probably around equal. Bernie may have passed Trump a little bit again, but there is something about Trump's mastery of this. And I think he came along at a moment of a ratings war, particularly on cable television. And so he has used the media in a way that I don't think anyone else has. And, you know, the issue here is not the media should not cover Donald Trump. The question is the media should cover him as critically as they cover anybody else. And he should not be getting the outrageous ratio of coverage compared to everybody else. So, yes, I do see it as a problem across the media that really needs some correcting.
Well, we have to end on that note. E.J. Dionne, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
It is great to be with you. Thank you.
You're very welcome. The book is called Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. And he's speaking tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia. And E.J. Dionne also does commentary on NPR's All Things Considered, a regular analyst for MSNBC, columnist for The Washington Post, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a professor at Georgetown University, a very lazy fellow, if I can say that. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.